The following is a North Carolina Baptist resource. For more, visit ncbaptist.org.
I'm glad you're here today. We'll kind of stay over to the side here so you can see the screen. But I guess around six years ago, the state convention did a reassessment of their whole strategy. And one of the things that they did is they hired a genius by the name of Kurt Waake to do a demographic research of our whole state. And the results were very, very surprising in that Kurt Waake discovered 250 pockets of lostness. A pocket of lostness is a geographic area up to a 3-mile radius in which the population in that area is highly unchurched, usually up around 70% or more unchurched. And you'd with a church, a state in the South that is in the Bible Belt, and a convention like the Baptist State Convention that has 4,300 churches, it might be a surprise that the percentage of unchurched lostness is so high. But that's just the way it is. That's the numbers speak for themselves. And so in these pockets of lostness, they are identified by several different categories. One is population density. There's usually a highly dense population in these areas, a high diversity within that population, not just one cultural group, and then population distance from the gospel. The people self-proclaim themselves to be far from God, non-religious, and in the religious questions that come on the census surveys, declining churches. We've identified all of the churches that are inside of these pockets of lostness, and 85% of them are plateaued or declining. And so that's scary when you see that you've got a pocket of lostness over 70% unchurched, and yet the churches inside of that pocket are declining. And then unreached people groups, if you look around and just observe the normal attendance in a church on Sunday morning in the Southern Baptist Convention, we are primarily a middle-class, white, Anglo-Saxon convention. And so when you see unreached people groups that have come in, we have over 800,000 immigrants that have moved into North Carolina. And we've identified 158 different people groups that have moved to North Carolina. The children in those families are coming home from public schools every day, and they're speaking in their homes over 300 different languages. And we have a state that's really changing, don't we? And then hard-to-reach population segments, and we're going to get into that a little bit more as we go through this process, but that's what a pocket of lostness is. And so what happened was they developed a whole new strategy at the state convention. They formed a strategy-focused team, which is the team that we are on. And what they did is they noticed that these 250 pockets of lostness are primarily located in 8 population centers across the state. And so they have now formed this team and have hired a strategy coordinator for each of these 8 population centers. And that's why you see Russ is in the Triad area, Greensboro, Winston-Salem, High Point. I am in the Blue Ridge area, Buncombe County and Asheville, and the counties surrounding Buncombe County. And then we have Fayetteville, we have Greenville, we have Wilmington, the Triangle area of Raleigh-Durham, Chapel Hill, Greensboro and Charlotte and Hickory. So those are those 8 population centers. And then we have a new guy on our team who is now reaching the 150 top pockets of lostness, working towards them that are not necessarily in these population centers, but that are spread out in maybe some of the more rural areas. So that's why we see the diversity across the state. So each of these little circles represents a pocket of lostness.
What's next?
Yeah. So I remember a few years ago reading when Jerry Rankin was the president of the IMB, he was writing about pancakes and waffles, and I'm a guy that likes to eat, so that got my attention. So what Rankin said was that we can't look at the world like it's a pancake, where when you pour syrup over it, it flows all over smoothly and gets all over it. But rather, he says it's more like a waffle, a matrix of squares separated by ridges. So he says if you want syrup all over your waffle, you have to deliberately pour it into each little square. And the picture here is of a world that is full of diverse peoples who are separated from each other by cultural barriers that keep the gospel from flowing cross-culturally. So if you think about that in terms of a pocket of lostness, you say, well, we want to look at this like it's a waffle, not a pancake. So we've had in some places an attempt to just sort of create a grid on a pocket of lostness and say, we've got a square here and a square here and a square here and a square here. The problem with that approach is that even within that square, there is such diversity and such cultural difference between people who live next door to each other that it's really more like spaghetti. It's not really like a pancake or a waffle. It's like spaghetti. And what I mean by that is that these hard-to-reach population segments are not contained in any circle or square. They meander all through the pocket. And it takes a different kind of strategy to reach each one of them sometimes. And so it's not about just isolating a circle or a square. It's finding that hard-to-reach population segment to engage with. So our goal in our state convention strategy of impacting lostness through disciple-making is to see sustainable, reproducible disciple-making taking place among every population segment in a lost pocket. So to see that happen, we know that no single church, no single ministry, no single strategy is going to reach every segment. So it's going to take, in every case, prayerful seeking. So we've got to go out and find out who are the hard-to-reach population segments in our pockets. It's going to take intentional relationship building. Is there somebody in my church that can reach across that cultural bridge and engage that Sudanese person in my neighborhood? It's going to take effective strategies. You know, we've got to start asking the question when we see diversity around us is, what's it going to take to reach these people? And then begin to answer that question very practically. And it's going to take kingdom cooperation to engage them all. This cannot be about the numerical growth of any one particular church. This has to be about cooperation with each other, across associations, across the state, church to church, partnering together with a focus on advancing God's kingdom. So what kinds of population segments are there? Steve?
So there are different kinds of population segments. One is ethnic, and we see a diversity in our communities. And I think one thing you've got to ask is, you know, if you drove around your community and you saw all of the different ethnic groups in your community, but you didn't see them in your churches, would that be a problem? And God has called us to reach all nations. Ethnos, which is better translated people groups, ethnic groups. And so when you look at the diversity, and sometimes maybe we are colorblind because we live in our own little worlds, and yet you see this, you know, you see these little businesses in your community, and some of them have Spanish words on them, some of them have Chinese words on them, some of them have Russian words on them, and that can give you an indicator of who's in your community. And so the different ethnic groups, socioeconomic groups, we have the poor, we have the middle class, we have the wealthy. Who are we reaching? Is it okay for us to just reach middle class people?
No.
Or is God calling us to reach the poor? What did Jesus say about reaching the poor? What did he say?
The poor you have with you always.
He said, the poor you'll have with you always. And then he said, I came to do what? To preach the gospel to who? To the poor. That's what he said. Why didn't he say, I came to preach the gospel to the middle class? Why didn't he say, I came to preach the gospel to the wealthy? Well, the reason is because there is a phrase that John Wesley coined called redemption lift. He noticed that as they began winning poor people to Christ in the methodology of the Methodist Church, as they began growing as disciples, they began developing all of these character qualities, and their economic condition lifted. There was a redemption lift that lifted them out of poverty and into middle class, and sometimes on up even into wealthy. So as redemption lift works, what happens? There always is a vacuum at the bottom. So I believe one reason Jesus said, I came to preach the gospel to the poor, is because there's always a vacuum there. We always have to intentionally go back to the poor and minister to them. Now, we love ministering to the poor, but so many times what we're doing is giving them a handout instead of a hand up. So many times we're giving them food and clothing, and we're meeting physical needs, but how many of them are we leading to Christ and building up into multiplying disciples of Christ? And so there's a socioeconomic reality. We've just gone through some special training in the state convention that one of our strategists developed, Dan Collison, on bridges out of poverty. And part of it is just understanding the difference between the poor, the middle class, and the wealthy. Think about the way we manage our money. The poor primarily spend money. The middle class primarily manages money. The wealthy primarily focus on investing money. See the difference between the three? I had just a conversation last night. A friend called. We're ministering to poor homeless veterans in our community together. And he said, Steve, this man's driving me crazy. He had $3,500 in his pocket on Thursday. He had $2 left on Friday. And he just simply blew it. And I begged him not to do that. But that's, I mean, if you, in our, we ministered to the poor when I was in California, and I remember that the week that we had the highest attendance was the week before they got their welfare checks. Because they were desperate. They were in a crisis. The money was gone. But on the day the welfare checks came, they dressed to the nines. They were standing by the mailbox when the check came, and they were out on the town. And before half of the month was over, all their money was gone. And then the next 2 weeks, they were in a crisis trying to figure out how they could survive until the next welfare check. So that's the difference in that. Then you've got residential. And we're going to see a slide in a minute how even sometimes in the same community, you can have wealthy and poor almost right next together to each other. But you've got to recognize and acknowledge that. Then you have lifestyle segments. We're going to look at some of those different lifestyle segments in a minute. Generational segments, think about the great generation, the baby boomers, and then the Gen Xers, and then the millennials, and how different all of us think, and how we relate differently, and we communicate differently. I remember when texting started really becoming big, and I would call a millennial and leave a message for him, and I'd get a text message back, and it would really make me mad. And I remember calling one guy. I said, listen, if I want a text message, I'll send you a text message, but if I call you and leave a message, I want you to call me back, because that means I want to talk to you.
And he sent you a text and said, okay.
Yeah. Exactly. Family structure. Now, we're approaching half of our families who are single parents. And we have multi-generational. We have grandparents raising their grandkids. Then we have the traditional family. We lived on a street in California. Our family was the only traditional family of a husband and wife and children on our whole street. Every other family was some other kind of structure. So you can see the different types of population segments.
Those are just a few. One pocket of lostness I was doing some research on last week, 60% of that pocket were single mother families. You know, so that's a huge segment. If a church is not intentionally trying to develop strategies to engage single mothers, they're missing that that pocket. So, and on that note, one of the things that I like to encourage churches to consider as they look at the segments in their pocket, the spaghetti strands in their pocket, is that every segment needs a champion. Not everybody in your church is going to care about being involved in ministering to a certain socioeconomic group, ethnic group, lifestyle group, whatever, but somebody's going to be really passionate about it. And that's the champion that we're looking for. We want to just find that person and just say, you know what, you are the lead on this, here it is. Because I was a pastor for 20 years, and I would go to meetings, and I would hear about all these statistics of all these people around us, and all I could think about was, I do not have time to take on this whole thing. But there were some cases where we found champions in our church who did have the time and the passion and the relationships to lead out. And so they became the champions for that segment. The champions build a team around them, and then the team develops a strategy to engage that segment. That's where we come in working together to talk about what makes a good strategy, what's going to be effective long term, what's sustainable, what's reproducible. And so as we locate the segments, think three things: champion, team, strategy. Because for every segment, we're going to have to find those key people and concepts. Steve's going to talk about some lifestyle segments they've encountered in Asheville.
Well, Asheville has been labeled a lot of things, as some of you know. The little San Francisco of the Southeast, Ash Vegas. I saw a t-shirt yesterday morning, a waiter at Sunny Point in West Asheville, that it was Ash Vegas. So it's a very diverse community. And it's burdened me. I'm a native son of Asheville. I grew up in Asheville, and I've seen the changes over the years. And I love diversity. It excites me. I'm not one of those who feels sad because Asheville has changed, because God has brought the world to us. Mm-hmm. And I was able to get some really great training in California from Peter Wagner at Fuller Seminary, who founded the School of Church Growth there. He coined a phrase called homogeneous unit principle. And basically it is, birds of a feather flock together. And this is not prescriptive of the way we do ministry. It's just descriptive of the fact that people can best come to Christ in the context of their own culture. And so one of the things that Peter said one day in class was, he said, we like to call America a melting pot. But he said, I don't like that term. I prefer the term tossed salad. Because a melting pot, everything blends in and looks the same. But a tossed salad, every part of that salad keeps its individual distinctive, but it joins together to create a beautiful, delicious dish. And so we have, our communities are more like tossed salads. They're very distinct cultural and under lifestyle segments, we have all kinds of different lifestyle and cultural segments in our population. And believe it or not, they just don't think the way we do. And so there are two segments that have been a burden and on my heart for a long time in our community. One is the LGBT community. We have the largest population per capita in the LGBT community of any city in the state of North Carolina. Durham is second behind Asheville. And so the question is, the challenge we have is, how can we reach this population segment with the gospel when there are aspects to the gospel that are already a turnoff to them because they feel like they're not accepted, they're not received in the way that they are, in the lifestyle that they are, is not embraced by Christianity. So what do you do with that? And so we have had a burden to reach this community, and it's just exactly like what Russ said. Every segment needs a champion. I'm not going to be effective at reaching the LGBT community because there is just not there's not a molecule of gayness in me. I'm a redneck Western North Carolina, you know, backpacker, hunter, and fisherman. And so I said, I've got to find a champion, someone who can relate to them. And so I have a prayer team, and we pray, and we pray, and we pray that God will raise up champions for these different population segments. And God raised up a lady by the name of Malia Allard, and she came out of this lifestyle. She was in this lifestyle for 12 years. She had a partner during that whole time. And she understands it. She lived it. She experienced it. And believe it or not, she was led to Christ by a loving Southern Baptist pastor. Isn't that awesome?
Yeah, it is.
And God just loved her out of that lifestyle. She broke up with her partner. She repented of her sin. She got married. And she has 3 grown children now and is thriving in her life. But God has called her back into that to minister and to reach that lifestyle. So everything I do to reach that community is through Malia. And she does about 10 to 15 hours of counseling each week, one-on-one with people who are struggling with same-sex attraction. She has a support group for young men. She has a support group for young women. And she has a support group for the family members who have children who are in that lifestyle. And so I just pour into Malia. I just pour everything I can into her. And you know, one of the sad things is she is greatly, greatly under-supported by the churches in our community. Well, our pastors love to get up and rant and rail against homosexuality, but they're not willing to put one penny into helping reach homosexuals. And that just infuriates me. And so I try to raise as much support for her as I can, because she's had to go get another job to support herself, and that cuts back on the number of hours she can put into that ministry. So if you find a champion of a population segment that you have a passion for that you know you can't reach, then give them some money. Give them some support. Give them some encouragement. Get behind them. And here, I saw a tweet by Danny Aiken recently. I love this. He said, I am a hero builder. I build platforms that heroes can stand on, and then I stand to the side and I clap and cheer. Mm-hmm. That's what we do as a strategy focus team. We are hero builders. We build platforms for people like Malia, and we support them and resource them and help them and encourage them. The Bohemian community, if you walk around downtown Asheville, you will see the Bohemians. Now, anytime you start describing a population segment, you can be accused of being racist or prejudiced or whatever. And there's none of that here. There's no place for racism or prejudice in the Christian faith, because all ground is level at the foot of the cross.
Amen.
Everybody comes the same way. But this is just a description of this segment. The Bohemians, the modern day hippies, the dreadheads, the granola girls, they're all over Asheville. And I've had a burden to reach them for many, many years, seeing them walking. And I knew, and I do know, that no one has been reaching them. No church has targeted them and reached them. And I was so burdened for them. And we had a pretty contemporary church reaching a lot of young families that when I was pastoring there. And I remember one morning a couple came in, and they were dreadheads and granola girls. They had body piercings and tattoos from the top of their head to the bottom of their toes, long dreadlocks. Even their little boy had dreadlocks. And I thought, finally, we've got a family. You know, we can reach them. And they went to the middle of the foyer. All these people came up to them and loved on them and welcomed them. But I watched them, and they did a 360. They turned around, and they looked at everybody in that room, and I knew exactly what they were doing. What were they doing?
Sizing up.
Looking for themselves.
They were looking to see if there was anyone else in that church that looked like them. And there wasn't. And when I saw them do that, I knew they would never be back. And they never came back. Man, that broke my heart, because we reached out to them every way we could. But they knew they just didn't fit. And so we began praying, who can reach the Bohemians? And our prayer group prayed for 3 years. And God finally, just 6 months ago, He raised up a man from Kentucky who is a bohemian hippie. He's an organic farmer, long beard. He's got the whole thing. And God, he saw what was going on in Asheville. And he said, God's calling us to come down here. So, man, we got behind him and our church planting team, our local director of missions, and myself. We just loved on him, and we brought him in. We get rolled out the red carpet. I took him to 12 Bones and gave him some ribs, and we had a good time. And we made him feel very welcome, and he sensed God calling him, brought his family in, and went over to the Drippolator coffee shop every morning at 7:30. That's where a lot of them come in, and now he's got a group of them that meets every morning at 7:30. Wow. And they're going to be launching their first worship service next Sunday.
Wow.
They visited a little church that's about to die, 15, 20 people, Ridgecrest Baptist Church. And those people just fell in love with his family, with Trent Holbert and his family. And the pastor came to visit him the next Tuesday night and said, you know what? In October, we voted to make our fellowship hall available for a new church plant, and we want to give it to you. We want to give you an office. We want to give you a nursery, and you can start using this for free. We'll pay all the utility bills, and we'll even volunteer to help in any way that we can. And so they've given him this building, and then this summer they're going to let him move into the parsonage. And so God has just opened up the doors for them, and our church plant team is supporting them, and he's already reaching. One of the bohemians that he's reaching is my niece's son, and he's got pink hair. And he's one of these screaming hard rockers. You know, they like the screaming music. I think they just call them screamers. But he's going to be in this guy's band, you know, and they're just connecting wonderfully. And he visited all these churches. He hadn't found one, but he's going to be on the core team of Trent Holbert's new church plant. So these awesome. Are examples of lifestyle segments.
We've got a question back here.
Yeah, about the LGBT, the problem with that is that a lot of them believe that they are safe. A lot of them do believe in Jesus. A lot of them do believe that, you know, that they're going to go to heaven. And that this is a lifestyle that this is where I'm at. And it's not that they chose that because they believe that that's how they were born in that. But that makes it hard because to get saved is what? To know that you're lost and that you need a Savior. But yeah, I've had a lot of friends. I've talked to a lot in the profession that I was in. And they're hard to talk to because, and they got preachers too. There's churches now that have preachers.
Yeah, there's a lot of mixed messages coming out of a lot of churches on that. And I think that's where getting down to this idea of champion team strategy can be really effective, is because really it's through that life on life disciple making that we begin to see that trade. I mean, you know, hey, I didn't think I was lost either. One time. But it took just life on life with some people who love Jesus and realizing that they got something I don't have, and God used that. So, yes, God's doing some great things up in Asheville. It's exciting. Every time our team gets together, I always love hearing Steve's stories about how this is. We're going to talk about some ethnic segments, some things that we're both seeing. And we'll just be real quick on this because I know this is something that Steve and I are both passionate about, and we could be here all day talking about these. But in each of these ethnic groups, we are seeing strategies come together through a variety of different catalysts and catalytic moments. So when you think about champion team and strategy, we have a large number in Greensboro of Bhutanese refugees. They're ethnically Nepali people. They were residents of the Kingdom of Bhutan, who then kicked them all out, and they had nowhere to go. They ended up in refugee camps in India and Nepal, and have now, by the tens of thousands, come to the United States, and many of them are in North Carolina. Well, it just so happens that in the city of Greensboro, there was a church that had been sending teams and money and resources to Nepal to reach Nepalis. And the pastor of this church found out that there were Nepalis coming to Greensboro, and he began to talk to other pastors, and they began to talk to their members and said, how can we work together to begin to engage these? And through that, we've seen the establishment of two churches for Nepali Bhutanese refugees. I know a lot about that one because I'm that pastor. that was my church that was doing all that in Nepal, and then we realized, hey, they're coming here. We have a lot of Congolese refugees. These are people who were basically displaced out of Congo into refugee camps in Uganda. And a few months ago, I get a contact from our church planting team that says, we have a guy here who wants to plant a church for Congolese people. Do you know, are there any Congolese people in the triad? And I said, yes, because we have a team working, a team of churches working in Pocket 30, northeastern Greensboro, who keep running into Congolese people. Well, this guy has become our champion. His name is Jean Munyambabazi. He was a pastor of about 14 different churches at the same time in an enormous Ugandan refugee camp. And he gets out in the community, starts going around meeting these Congolese people. He found 9 families that were part of his church in Uganda. And so different avenues, different champions, different catalytic moments there. West African Muslims. There's a statistic that we've seen that nobody knows the exact source of or whether or not it's accurate. The Hausa people of Nigeria and Niger are, if not the, they are certainly one of the most, one of the largest unreached people groups on the continent of Africa. And the statistic we keep seeing that we don't have any way of confirming is that there are more of them in Greensboro than in any other country in the world outside of West Africa.
Ones that I've talked to in Greensboro that I've tried to reach out to, they think that it's a bad omen to talk about another God. That's why it's so hard to reach them. Like, I give out crosses and whatnot, and a lot of them that I've met at convenience stores, working at convenience stores, and I went in and I give them a cross or whatnot, and they'll stick their hands up, and they'll go, No, bad luck. No.
So, interesting thing is, there's a church in South Carolina that has been engaging Hausa people for a good while. We found out a few years ago that they were actually sending mission teams to Greensboro to prayer walk and build relationships. And so we got in touch with that church and started talking to them. They said, we have a student at Southeastern Seminary right now who wants to go to West Africa as a missionary when she graduates. And we've created an internship for her at the state convention where she gets paid one day a week to come hang out with Muslim women in Greensboro and build relationships with them that's leading to gospel sharing and disciple-making opportunities. And so it's just a different approach. We've got a different champion, different kind of work going on, but God's using it. Among Hispanics, we have, I think, 3 or 4 established Hispanic churches in Greensboro that are affiliated with our association. Out of potentially 150,000 Hispanics in Guilford County, the census data won't tell you that because we estimate that there are 2 undocumented for every documented Hispanic in Guilford County. So potentially 150,000. We're engaging through the churches that exist there about 500. You say, wow, we're engaging 500. Yes, but there are 150,000. So is planting one more church going to make a bigger impact? Is planting 10 more churches going to make a bigger impact? So we started talking and discovered that in Cuba, there is a massive church planting movement going on through multiplying house churches. And through some connections that we had with various people, we found a guy who'd just come here from Cuba who was a leader in that house church planting movement. And Lord willing, he gets his work permit soon. We're going to turn him loose to begin to start this kind of network that has the potential to engage hundreds and hundreds and then thousands of Hispanics in a very short amount of time. He said to me recently, he said, do you have any work for me to do? And I said, I can't give you work to do because you don't have a work permit. He said, do I have to have a permit to share the gospel? I said, nope. He texted me the next day from a Mexican restaurant, and he said, I just shared the gospel with 20 people in the Mexican restaurant. Do you have a place that I can start meeting with them in a small group? So he's already got 3 different small groups going on in various parts of the city, and he's not getting paid a dime. He doesn't have a job description or anything. He's just a guy out sharing the gospel, and we're seeing God do some great stuff. Steve?
So this is also a big population segment in the Blue Ridge area. We have around 12,000 Hispanics in Buncombe County. And again, there's a great discrepancy between those that are documented and those that are undocumented. Now, let me just say something about this biblically that may rest your conscience a little bit, because there's a lot of tension right now in our nation over immigration, especially illegal immigration, documented, undocumented. What is the church's role? What position should we take on what the government should be doing about DACA and about those that are in our nation illegally and that kind of thing? Here's something that I think will help you. The government has a different set of questions that they have to answer than the church does.
That's right.
We need to trust the government and pray for the government. They'll have wisdom to answer those questions the way they need to answer them. Doesn't mean we can't have an opinion about that, but that's their job. But we have a different set of questions that in the minute they step foot in our community, they become our responsibility to share the gospel. This is a golden opportunity. Why in the world would you take a short-term mission team to Honduras if you're going to ignore the Honduran that lives right next door to you in your own community? Now, yes, short-term mission trips are wonderful. But let's not ignore the fact that God has brought them to us. There's a verse in Acts that I just have been gripped over as Paul is preaching to the Areopagus in Athens. And he said, "And God made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling places, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward Him and find Him, yet He is actually not far from each one of us." It is providential that we have 43 million immigrants in our nation right now, and all the refugees that have come. And we our church has adopted a community in Clarkston, Georgia, as our Samaria ministry that has refugees from over 100 nations, because they fly into the Atlanta airport, the government gives them rents them an apartment in Clarkston, takes them over there, gives them $3,000, and they're on their way. They're on their own. And so we see the providential nature of this. Now, something has changed with the Hispanics. In the past, the traditional method of reaching Hispanics was for a church to open up their worship space and to give a Hispanic pastor some free space to start a church. And he would put up a sign outside the church that alongside your church's sign that says that there's a Hispanic church meeting here, and open up the doors and start reaching Hispanics in the community, and Hispanics would come. Now that is changing because of the fear, the great fear that they have of being deported because of the tension that's going on right now. So our church hosted a Hispanic church plant. Actually, the same name as our church, New Life Community Church, just in Spanish. They set a sign right next to our sign. It started growing. We had 60 or 80 Hispanics coming. And they had a van, and they were going out and picking up Hispanics, bringing them in. One night on their way to church, there was a license check by the sheriff's department. There's only one road into our church and one road out. And they believed with all of their heart that that was targeting them because of the sign out by our church that said that Hispanic church met there. So we lost half of our congregation that night. They would never come back. And so what's happening with this Cuban strategy that he just talked about, I believe is going to be the wave of the future, because they can do house church. And it's almost secretive. They're going to have to do church the way the Chinese do it in China. Because of the fear that they have of being caught and deported. So that whole strategy is changing because of what's happening. We've got to be aware of that, of what's going on. Chinese, in our community, I've noticed for years now, all the Chinese restaurants. And if you go to Chinese restaurants, who's working there? Chinese people. What did you say?
He said Mexicans.
Well, eating. The Mexicans love to eat at the Chinese restaurants, the buffets. Amazing. So anyway, they're Chinese restaurant workers, and we've got 19 Chinese restaurants in our area, And so what's the burden? One day I look on the North Carolina Baptist website, and there's an interview with a man by the name of Kevin Dong. He lives in Virginia Beach. He owns two Chinese restaurants, but he was born in a city in China where many of the restaurant owners in America come from. They speak a dialect of Mandarin that's different than even regular Mandarin. But his parents were led to Christ by Southern Baptist missionaries in China. He grew up in a Christian home. He had a heart to plant churches. He's already planted four churches with Chinese restaurant workers. He speaks their dialect. He speaks the particular dialect of Mandarin that they speak. And so I called him and I said, is there any possibility you'd come up to Asheville and help us get a work started with Chinese restaurant workers? He said, I'd love to. So he travels up and we get in the car and we start going to Chinese restaurants. We walk in the door, the owner's standing there. He starts speaking to the owner in that particular dialect, and the owner's eyes just light up. And there's an instant rapport between them. This happened one after one. We just went all the way through. We walk into the Wild Walk at the Asheville Mall. Beautiful young lady behind the counter. She looks up. She sees Kevin. Her eyes light up. She runs around. She throws her arms around him and starts hugging him. I think, what's going on here? Well, he trained her how to be a manager 10 years ago. And they had just reconnected. They didn't even know where the other one was. And so that rapport, Kevin has a connection with them. He's the champion. And now in March, he's coming up, and we're going to go to more Chinese restaurants and start a Bible study, and we're looking for a church to adopt them. So this is the kind of way that we can begin tapping into these different ethnic segments.
Don't go anywhere.
Yeah.
Talk about multifamily housing.
Okay.
I just have one question about that, what you were just talking about. You're making it sound like we can't reach those people.
No, yes,
like it's right. All we have to wait for one person to be risen, raised up. Not that I'm saying they can, because I don't know that I can speak their language, but I have a heart for them too.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? So.
Yeah, and you may be the best champion that your church or your association has right now, and that's good. Go for it.
Yeah.
Go for it. In each of these cases, we were blessed by God's providence to find people. Like, I think about our intern who's working with the West African Muslims. I mean, she's a white American girl, you know. She just has a passion for these people. And, she's going to... Chris, you were...
I was just going to add to that. Anytime your heart goes out, God just pulls your heart out for somebody like that. We served in China for 10 years, and I can tell you, language was never a barrier.
That's right.
God always found a way around it. You might meet an English speaker. God might bring some Chinese speakers along with us, Chinese or West African, whatever. But if he started in your heart, you just keep walking faithfully.
That's right.
And he'll bring the people along. But I promise you, language will not get in the way.
Yeah.
He always finds a way around.
My wife and I, years ago, we were in North Wilkesboro at a Chinese restaurant, and there was a young Caucasian white, teenage girl who was sitting with, I don't know if the girl worked at the restaurant or if she was the owner's daughter, but she was teaching her English in the restaurant, so I knew there was I'm guessing she was a believer, but maybe she was as possible.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I did not intend for that to come across. God calls you, go.
Yeah.
And if you get a passion to reach a certain population segment, don't wait for a champion. Just go love on them, and he'll open up the doors of communication.
Are you using person of peace and the connection person kind of synonymously here?
A person of peace usually is the person you find on the inside of the segment. So the champion is the believer who's going in to engage them. The person of peace is who they're looking for to make that initial connection, with. It may be a seeker or a new believer or somebody who's just being friendly and hospitable. But a person of peace is important in this process.
Something else you can do too, like the place that I work full time has a lot of Hispanics, and we've noticed that a lot of me being the only pastor that works there, everybody kind of looks at me and says, you need to talk to them. Well, they don't understand a word I'm saying. Mm-hmm. So what I did is I got into Google and I looked for Spanish Christian churches. And I found a Spanish Christian church.
And what I did is went to that church, talked to the pastor there. He gave me a whole stack of Spanish written Bibles and put his name and everything inside of it. So what I did is went around and I started handing these Bibles out, just putting them on their desks and the work areas where they worked at, and they would grab it quick because it was written in Spanish. And so far, within the last 2 years, 19 of them have come to Christ and go to this church.
Praise God.
I mean, God used me to bring the Bibles, but he used the church that speaks their language to reach them. So I think there's a lot of tools like that, even though we're not. We can, you know, we got a lot of Mandarin people that speak Mandarin here. You can look up on Google and whatnot, Mandarin churches or whatnot, and get some literature that you can at least give them.
Or call your area strategy coordinator. We can help you with that too.
Yeah, direct them to the where they need to go.
Yeah.
We have a blonde-haired, blue-eyed young single lady that's reaching Gujarati and Punjabi Indians now.
Yeah.
She just loves them. She goes and meets the ladies and asks them if she can come over to their house so they can teach her how to cook Indian food. And that's how she's getting in, because she's called to that ministry. Residential segments. We began seeing in our pockets of lostness many apartment complexes, mobile home parks, multi-family housing complexes, and we discovered 95% of multifamily housing residents in America are unchurched. Did you get that? That is approaching an unreached people group, the apartment nation, because they're so mobile. And so we had to develop this. And so we brought in a specialist, Eric Boykin from Alabama, who trained us for 2 days and showed us three strategies of how to do that. The intentional strategy is when a church, you go in, you establish a ministry there, maybe after school program, you find out the needs of these places, and then you reach them, maybe start a Bible study there, and bring them into your church on Sunday morning for worship. For pastors that are hungry to see their church grow, it's a great way. Get into the apartment complex, get something going there, bring them into church on Sunday morning. Incarnational is you place a family in that complex, and that's the best way to do it, because if they live there, they have all kinds of special privileges. First of all, don't believe that apartment managers do not want your church in their apartment complex. They have to uphold fair housing laws, and we have to respect those. But if we respect them and go in to help, and to help them build community in that apartment complex, then they will begin opening up those doors of opportunity. And then the indigenous is that someone inside there has a burden, and maybe it'd be good for you to poll your church and find out how many people in your church live in apartment complexes. And if you find someone who does, then you can start an indigenous approach from the inside out and begin working through them to reach that complex.
Yeah, they definitely, as Steve said, it's not that they don't want your church in there. They don't want your church's flyers littering the parking lot. And every apartment manager I've talked to has said, first thing they've said is, y'all aren't going to pass out flyers, are you? Because they're tired of picking up trash from churches. So knocking on doors and flyers, not a priority for us. Relationships through intentional incarnation or indigenous strategies are. This is a picture. I want to talk about socioeconomic real quick. Steve was talking about earlier the need to strategize to reach the poor, the middle class, and the wealthy. This is an aerial photo from Google Maps of a scene inside Pocket 22, which is in center of Greensboro. Anybody here familiar with Greensboro? Starmount Country Club, you know where I'm talking about? This is part of Starmount Country Club right here. Okay, this house right here. This is Stanton Drive, and this house just sold for $850,000. Beautiful place. Houses across the street, tree line. These are the colonial apartments. They rent for $500 a month. They're filled with mostly immigrants and refugees. Very low socioeconomic, very high crime. What's separating the rich and the poor? A tree line. There are four Southern Baptist churches surrounding this little area here. And no single one of them is going to reach everybody in that. So where there are champions who can begin to build teams to engage those low socioeconomics, those ethnic groups, even the high socioeconomic, because, you know, the up and outs are just as lost as the down and outs. Yeah. And so, I mean, you know, somebody told me the other day that they live in this area around the country club, and they said, well, I just feel so, like, you know, because they said all my neighbors are all wealthy, and, you know, like so she couldn't do anything. You know, and I said, you realize God's put you in a mission field that Jesus said was harder to reach than squeezing a camel through the eye of a needle. Like, you have a very strategic opportunity there. So, yeah, so sometimes the socioeconomic lines are really, really close together. And when we see that right there. So champions, teams, strategies. We've put together some action steps. Steve, what can you do now that you know about the spaghetti in your pockets?
There's a strategy called the four fields approach, which is part of the T for T training for trainers strategy. And it has its own resources. It is a system in and of itself, a wonderful system that I would highly recommend. If you look up four fields or training for trainers or T for T, they have all kinds of resources to accomplish this. But there are many other resources that we can plug in here. But let me just explain it. You start out with the empty field, and that is your entry plan. How are you going to get into the field? And see, part of the thing is that we get desperate to share the gospel, but we haven't taken time to enter the field and prepare the field. You've got to plow it up. You have to fertilize it. You've got to get it ready. That is through relationships. It is through community service. It is through meeting desperate needs in the community. It is through getting in and gaining friendships and relationships. And we have to take the time to prepare the field. And so the question is, what is your church's entry into the field? How are you going to enter the field of lostness in your community? How are you going to be strategic about serving desperate needs in your community so that you can build relationships with those people? How are you going to build relationships with people in your network who are lost and invest into their lives? And so with each of these different population segments, you have to answer the question, how are we going to enter the field? How are we going to prepare it? How are we going to build relationships? How are we going to serve and meet needs in that community? Then once you've built a rapport and built a relationship and maybe found a person of peace, someone inside who is open, then we begin planting the seed of the gospel. And we plant the seed of the gospel. There are many different ways to do that, but the gospel is the gospel. And so I think that it's more important that we get the gospel right than we find the right program or plan. Because it is a message of Jesus, creation, separation, restoration, resurrection. And so we've got to plant the seed of the gospel, and we need to have confidence. It is the gospel that changes lives.
That's right.
It's not our programs. It's not our strategies. Amen. It's not our methodology. It's Jesus. And there's a supernatural power in the power of the cross and the power of the resurrection that is transformative. And when you share that good news with some Muslims, they're saying, why did you wait so long to tell us this good news? We've been living under this legalistic Islam system for all these years. We didn't know about the grace of God. And so have confidence in the power of the gospel to change lives and present it boldly. We've got a guy from Indonesia who has gone out to many Muslims, and his name's Mike Shipman, and he said the best way to find out if a Muslim is open to the gospel is to share the gospel with them. You'll find out if they're open to it, you know? And that's what he does. Then once they accept Christ, then you need to have a discipleship plan. How are you going to disciple new believers? You need to answer this question in your church as well as these other population segments you're going to reach. And so we need a plan. It needs to be gospel-centered. It needs to be sequential. And it needs to be easily transferable. There are lots of plans that are available for that. T for T is one of them. The Four Fields approach, they have their own plan for how you can disciple new believers and get them rooted and grounded in the faith. And then once you get them rooted and grounded in the faith, the Harvest Field Church Formation which in our churches would be new small groups. It's New Testament community. But if it's a population segment that you're trying to reach, then you probably want to start with a house church, a Bible study. But you form these people into New Testament community, and as these communities are built, then the Holy Spirit is going to be in the middle of all of this, and there's leadership development and multiplication, a plan for multiplying leaders. It's not; it doesn't have to be complicated. You get a leader, and that leader recruits another leader to come alongside of them for a year, and they've got an associate, they've got a helper, and they watch, and they just slowly. Here's the way heart surgeons are trained and airline pilots are trained. You do it while they're watching, they do it while you're watching, and they do it. That's the apprenticeship approach to leadership development. That's the best way to train anyone to do anything, is leadership training. And that way you're always multiplying leaders, and you can have more leaders than you'll ever need if every leader will bring someone alongside of them and do that. You want to finish that
up? Yeah, sure. So some immediate action steps for you. Prayer walk your community. That's simple. So I had somebody ask me recently, how do you prayer walk? Okay, you have to be able to do three things. You have to be able to pray and walk and do two things at the same time. If you can do that, you can prayer walk. What you're doing when you're prayer walking is you're asking God to show you those spaghetti strands. Show us who's out here, Lord. And show us a person of peace. And show us an entry strategy. As Steve said, sometimes we're in such a hurry to get to field two, we jump over field one. I tell you, a problem I'm having in some of our pockets of lostness is churches want to build a house in field one and live there. They've entered, and they keep trying to enter. And I'm like, no, you're in. Like, get to the gospel now. You know, entry things are great, but once you're in, do something. You know, ask God to show you the entry points. Ask Him to show you, you know, how are we going to share the gospel here? So prayer walking. And record what you observe out there. I mean, we have statistical information that we can pull up. You know, the problem with statistics is that they're outdated as soon as they are published, you know. So with immigrant communities and the various kinds of segments from it, there's a lot of turnover, a lot of mobility. And, you know, by the time we get a statistic that shows up on our computer screens, those people may have entirely relocated. So as you're out prayer walking, you may discover things that we don't even know. So communicate that with us. Number two, assess the vitality of your local church. Basically, are you making disciples in your church? One of the reasons why we have pockets of lostness is that we've got pastors who haven't been well discipled, leading churches that they can't disciple, and trying to get them to go out and make disciples in the community. No wonder it's not working. So, like, if that's the case, own it and let's start trying to fix it. Like, because pretending that that's not the case is not helping. So we have a church revitalization team. This conference is being put on by the disciple-making team. These are people that we can bring in to talk to you about how we can move forward with the disciple-making process to create that culture that spills over into the community. Build disciple-making relationships in the community. There are people that you can be a champion for. And so, you know, find them and begin those conversations. I heard it, Josh Reed, our evangelism specialist, told me this past week. He said, you know, the paradigm has shifted from gospel presentation to gospel conversation. I don't know about you guys, but I was trained in about 10 different gospel presentations. You know, 3-minute, here's 4 spiritual laws or whatever, this outline thing. Like, that's not where we are today. We're in gospel conversations, so start having them with people around you. Join or form a local strategy team with other church partners. If you're near a pocket of lostness, even if you're not, talk to one of us. We'll try to get you connected with other churches in your area that you can partner with to begin developing strategies to engage these population segments. One of the ways that you can get very well-versed on who's around you is to sign up for Mission Insight. Every church in the convention has access to this tool, one user per church. Mission Insight is a demographic website that one user per church can sign up for access to. You can plot your church members on it. You can do all kinds of mapping and everything, demographic studies. I've got some business cards here. If we can help you get connected with Mission Insight, let us know. They just changed the user interface. I've been learning it for 6 months, and they just changed how everything works on it. So I've got to go back to school. a couple of weeks, I'm doing a webinar to learn how to use the new version of it. We're having across the state training sessions on Bridges Out of Poverty. Steve mentioned it earlier. I know March 22nd, it's in the Triad. I don't know the dates of the others, and you guys are going back to the drawing board, right, to reschedule yours. So if you'll just let one of us know you're interested in attending Bridges Out of Poverty, we believe so strongly in this, not just that you can help people leave poverty, but actually it helps us learn how to enter that culture to share the gospel. That's the thing it did for me. It was open my eyes. I got to learn a culture and a language here. So if you want to attend one of those, we're actually, our team is footing the bill for about 2/3 of your registration cost because we're so committed to this as a strategy builder. So let one of us know if you want to attend that. We'll get you the date that's closest to you. Join or form a multi-housing ministry cohort. I've got a couple of churches in Greensboro that are coming together basically to encourage each other, bounce ideas around how to engage these 95% unchurched people in apartment complexes. And then connect with one of us. You've probably got a strategy coordinator in your area that would love to talk to you about the pockets of lostness and the segments that are within that spaghetti that's inside of there. We've got 1 minute for questions. Yes, sir.
I think 10 years ago, our pastor said something like, "Do you know your neighbor?" Mm-hmm. And I was really convicted about it. I was like, "No." But my wife and I just moved 2 years ago to this neighborhood, and I was really excited. I wanted to know all my neighbors because when I grew up, we just, everybody knew everybody. But I just wonder, you know, we've got so many churches, but we have members, and you know, if they could start to get to know their neighbors.
Yeah, yeah.
And what kind of multiplication?
That's one of the things that I'm encouraging churches I'm working with to do through Mission Insight is to plot their membership. Let's look at where their members live in relation to population segments, pockets of lostness, and see about building into their lives that idea of reproducible disciple making. Yeah.
Do you have a suggestion for specific Bible studies or material used for non-believers?
We're told different things by different people that are effective. You know, I think, Chris, you got any to come to mind?
You know, what I would do is just give us a description of who that unbeliever is. You know, are they a Hausa from West Africa? Are they Chinese? Are they
American college student who's a none of the above religiously? You know, it's going to take different methodologies. Yeah.
Yeah, we might be able to dial in on something that's a little more meaningful. You know, the gospel is the same.
That's right.
But they may have different questions, different things they struggle with.
Yeah.
And a different study might address some of those a little bit better. But if you'll get in touch with one of us, we'll try to find that.
Yeah, I would say some things to just across the board. Get the gospel right, relationship, and story. Like, I think that all three of those things have a really powerful connection for anybody, no matter how you plot. Yeah.
I was just wondering, I know earlier we were talking about the apartment complexes and whatnot, and but Greensboro is loaded with apartment complexes.
Mm-hmm.
And quite a few trailer parks. What is the best way to go into them? Because like you said, they don't like you to put the flyers out.
Right.
They don't like you to knock on the doors.
Are you in Greensboro?
Yeah.
Okay, let me tell you afterwards about our next multi-housing cohort meeting.
Okay.
And that would be a good starting point, is to come and sit in on one of those.
Okay.
Yeah. Anybody else? Well, thank you guys.